Hello, I'm Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here at Cedar Ridge. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We're going to begin a new series today on the Book of Psalms, and I think it's really timely for us to be in that part of the Bible. We're in a moment of heightened awareness about racial injustice in our society, and I think it's really important that we don't just move on. We're in a time of repentance, of guilt and shame, even a time of remorse where we're reflecting deeply about the nature of injustice in our society. And we had a wonderful prayer vigil just over a week ago. That was a really meaningful experience for all of us. But it's really important that we don't just move on from there. So at Cedar Ridge, we're going to be staying in this moment, reflecting deeply and processing the issues. You may have heard earlier in the service that the racial justice team is going to be coordinating a series of Zoom meetings. We had our first one last night, in fact, where we're beginning to process the nature of injustice and really hold one another accountable to take action and bring about change. And in this series on the Psalms, we're going to be touching on these issues as well. We'll be exploring both the issues, the challenging issues of that Psalms bring us in terms of injustice, and also the comfort that can be brought from the Psalms for those who are struggling and suffering at the moment. We've called this series Psalms, a Soundtrack for Our Lives. So let's just unpack that title a little bit. The Psalms are these beautiful musical poems that reflect a whole diversity of ways of approaching, relating to, and experiencing God. And there's all kinds of different genres in there. We'll touch on that in a moment. We've called it a Soundtrack for Our Lives because I think we could all relate to the fact that music is such a powerful force in human culture. We can all relate to probably songs and music that have played a key role in our lives at different times. Songs and music that resonate with where we're at, that kind of touch our emotions, perhaps help us relate and access our emotions in ways we couldn't do on our own. And as we do that, we then realize that other people have those emotions, and we know that we're not alone. So music is very powerful, and those songs and music stay with us throughout our lives. I'm sure we could all think of songs like that. And our lives themselves are very diverse. Like within any one of our lives, individually, we have extremes of experiences. We have ups and downs, and sometimes we feel like we're going forward, and sometimes we feel like we're going backwards. But we all live very different lives from one another. We're unique. I mean, I think a great example of that at the moment in the situation we're in our culture, some of us are feeling guilt and shame and the need for repentance and accountability, while others of us are feeling the weight of the burden of oppression and need strength and rest and healing. And we get all of that in the Psalms because the Psalms express such extreme and varied emotions. So a few words about the Psalms in general, since this is our first week. They're ancient literature, written centuries ago, and then gathered together in the form we have now, 150 of them in the Book of Psalms, around the 3rd century BCE. They're there as a book, one book in our Bible, but they're actually a collection of five books. We don't need to get into that too much today, but each individual book, each individual collection has a wealth of variety. We have psalms of lament, psalms of repentance, hymns of praise and thanksgiving. There's wisdom psalms and comforting psalms. It really covers pretty much the whole of the human experience. And that diversity, let me give you a kind of an example of some of this diversity. We see that diversity between Psalms. So, for instance, in Psalm 22, it begins, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus quoted that psalm on the cross. And that expresses the anguish of feeling forsaken by God, this sense that God's absent, which I think we can all relate to. But then there's another Psalm, 139, which we'll actually be touching on and digging in deeper next week, where it says, where can I go to flee your presence? If I go to heaven, you are there. If I go down into Sheol, the underworld, you are there. In other words, God is everywhere, all the time, every moment. And there's almost a hint there of not rather than feeling forsaken, of like maybe I want to get away from God's presence. Maybe it's the scrutiny is too much, or the or the sense of unconditional love can be hard to accept at times. So there's two very diverse emotions expressed in those psalms, two very different perspectives. But then within any one given psalm, there's diversity and difference. So Psalm 13, for instance, we read that at the beginning of our prayer vigil last week. And that begins, "How long, O God, will you forget me forever?" And goes on, "Look at me and answer." So there's anger and anguish in this psalm. And I think we can all relate to that. That again, it's sort of related to that sense of abandonment. But then it ends with, "But I will trust in your unfailing love." And there's a sort of a catharsis. There's a surrender. There's a letting go. There's a giving in, if you like, to the presence of God, to the faithfulness of God. So, very different emotions expressed within one given psalm. We have beautiful tenderness in the psalms. A few weeks ago, we looked at Psalm 23, which begins, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, I lack for nothing." That relationship of shepherd and sheep is this beautifully tender metaphor. But then we also have violence in the psalms. For instance, and we'll look at this one together, in Psalm 11, verse 6, it says, "On the wicked he will rain fiery coals and burning sulfur. A scorching wind will be their lot." And that's kind of mild by some standards with other psalms. There's the wicked kind of come in for a hard time in the psalms. They're almost cursed, or psalms sort of almost call curses on them. And there's an identification of enemies, and often those enemies are viewed as the wicked and they're cursed. And I think we have to be careful with all this, because we need to read the psalms in their literary context. They're poems. They're using metaphor. They're using hyperbole and extreme imagery to make a point. And I don't think the psalms necessarily are validating or condoning any particular emotion. They're just being very real and honest about the emotion that's already there. And that's why we can relate to them. It's then out of that context of reality and honesty that we can respond to them. When we think about this issue of enemies in particular, I think it's we have to be careful with that too, because I think our natural inclination is to think, that would be wrong, right? We don't want to have enemies, and we don't want to, that's, Jesus said, love your enemies. And, we can feel some tension there. But very often in the Psalms, enemies are associated with injustice. For instance, like in Psalm 11, which I just quoted in verse 6, I quoted verse 6, right after that, the final verse, verse 7, it says this, "For the Lord is righteous, he loves justice, the upright will see his face." So there's anger against the wicked, but that anger is actually against injustice. And I think that if we realize that, it can give us a deeper insight into the emotion of these psalms. For instance, if you are feeling oppressed, if you are feeling that you're being treated unjustly, then the fact that somebody sees that and kind of identifies the fact that you have enemies, that they're real, that I think is a source of comfort. You're seen, you're not forgotten, you're not being ignored. And likewise, I think we can feel the challenge that God is not passive in the face of injustice. And do we want a God that's passive in the face of injustice? I don't think so. So as we'll see in the psalm we're going to look at today, in some respects, we might be the enemies. We might be passive in the face of racial injustice. I think that's something that white people are collectively having to own right now. And that's a good and healthy thing. It merits dramatic, extreme language, because it's an extreme situation. So as I mentioned, today we're going to look at one psalm. We're going to look at Psalm 40. So before we unpack that a little bit, Carolyn is going to read the whole psalm to us, and then we'll discuss a few aspects about it.
Psalm 40. "I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear the Lord and put their trust in him. Blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, who does not look to the proud, to those who turn aside to false gods. Many, Lord my God, are the wonders you have done, the things you plan for us. None can compare with you. Were I to speak and tell of your deeds, they would be too many to declare. Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but my ears have opened. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. Then I said, here I am, I've come, it is written about me in the scroll. I desire to do your will, my God, your law is within my heart. I proclaim your saving acts in the great assembly. I do not seal my lips, Lord, as you know. I do not hide your righteousness in my heart. I speak of your faithfulness and your saving help. I do not conceal your love and your faithfulness from the great assembly. Do not withhold your mercy from me, Lord. May your love and faithfulness always protect me. For troubles without number surround me. My sins have overtaken me and I cannot see. They are more than the hairs of my head, and my heart fails within me. Be pleased to save me, Lord. Come quickly, Lord, to help me. May all who want to take my life be put to shame and confusion. May all who desire my ruin be turned back in disgrace. May those who say to me, aha, be appalled at their own shame. But may all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. May those who long for your saving help always say, the Lord is great. But as for me, I am poor and needy. May the Lord think of me. You are my help and my deliverer. You are my God. Do not delay.
The Psalms were actually meant to be sung. They were accompanied by music. And you may have noticed at the beginning of the service, we had a modern musical interpretation of the first part of this psalm, Psalm 40. We're going to unpack the psalm now a little bit. Let's read the first section again. It says, I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear the Lord and put their trust in him. I think what we have here is a metaphor that is perhaps the theme for the psalm. It's the slimy pit and God lifting us out of that slimy pit. I imagine that most of us have not actually been in a slimy pit. I know I haven't. The closest I probably came to that was one winter, or so it was at the end of winter, beginning of spring, just after a pretty heavy snowfall, which had melted. And I needed to go and see, attend to the bees at the Cedar Ridge property. And I made the genius decision to drive down there across the grass in my Corolla, which is not a four-wheel drive. And of course, I got stuck. And the harder I tried to get unstuck, the deeper I sank into the mud. You may have had an experience like that. And so I had to make the call of shame, and Mark Hartley graciously came out with a tractor and pulled me out. But I think we can all relate to this metaphorically, right? We've all been in situations, slimy pits, if you like, where we just can't get out of them. We feel trapped in a situation. It doesn't matter what we do, we seem stuck. We might be in situations like that right now, even. And not only that, but our emotional reactions can sometimes result in us flailing about and losing our center and losing perspective, and we just sink deeper and deeper into the mud. It doesn't really help us. It just makes it worse. We get even more stuck. This psalm, I think, is all about centering on God. I waited patiently for the Lord, the first line, is perhaps a reflection on the fact that maybe God is not absent or God is present, but we don't always experience it. We're not always centered on it or conscious of that presence. And as we reestablish that center and center ourselves on God, center ourselves on absolute love, on unconditional love and acceptance, it gives us firm foundation. It gives us something steady and firm to hold on to and to stand on. And we are slowly lifted up. We have a new perspective, a new song in our mouths. So let's bear that in mind as we go through the rest of the psalm. It goes on to say, blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, who does not look to the proud, to those who turn aside to false gods. Many, Lord my God, are the wonders you have done, the things you planned for us. None can compare with you. Were I to speak and tell of your deeds, they would be too many to declare. So I think what we have here is a sense of worship. It's a very worshipful section, that end part particularly. And worship is about centering. Worship is ascribing worth to something. It's ascribing value to something. It's centering on something. And the psalmist is saying that we it seems, easily get knocked off that center. We get knocked off the center of God, knocked off the center of absolute unconditional love. And he mentions, or the writer mentions a couple of things here that seem to knock us off our center. One is pride. Perhaps that's our insistence that we should be self-sufficient. We shouldn't get into situations like this in the first place. Perhaps we're in some kind of denial. Or we need to be able to get out of these situations and out of our problems, out of our pain on our own. We don't need other people. And you know, those attitudes are going to keep us in the pit. They're going to keep us in the mud. We're going to stay stuck. The other thing the psalmist mentions is false gods. Perhaps these are the things that we use artificially to prop ourselves up, to sort of con ourselves, trick ourselves into thinking that we're not really in a pit, that everything's okay. Again, that could be denial. It could be things we do to anesthetize ourselves from the reality of the slimy pit. And I think an interesting way of looking at this could be if we think about being centered on God, centered on absolute unconditional love. That's a place of peace out of which we can love ourselves and accept ourselves. It's a place of peace out of which we can love others and accept others, even with all our differences. If we become too focused on ourselves, if the center shifts, we tend towards self-pity. We tend towards a sense of martyrdom, perhaps. If we shift ourselves too much to other people, we can become competitive and critical of other people because we need to pull other people down to make ourselves feel better about ourselves. Or maybe we become almost the opposite, people pleasers. You know, we need to be validated by everybody else. And we shift off our center. Again, those approaches will keep us stuck in the mud, keep us in that miry clay. So the psalmist is calling us back to ascribe worth and value to the center, which is God and God's love. The psalmist goes on, sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but my ears you have opened. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. Then I said, here I am, I have come. It is written about me in the scroll. I desire to do your will, my God. Your law is within my heart. I proclaim your saving acts in the great assembly. I do not seal my lips, Lord, as you know. I do not hide your righteousness in my heart. I speak of your faithfulness and your saving help. I do not conceal your love and your faithfulness from the great assembly. So again, we have a very worshipful element here at the end of not hiding away this sense of ascribing worth and value and centering ourselves on God and God's love and the action of God's love in the world. But there's this sort of counterpart to it. There's in the first part, which is where the psalmist says, here I am, and you have written your law in my heart. There's this honesty and openness and vulnerability, I think, about this connection to God, this experience of God, which is in contrast to necessarily a religious experience. I mean, there's almost an anti-religious sentiment here. You don't want burnt offerings. You don't want religious ceremony. You don't want that sort of the trappings of spirituality. You want honesty and reality. And this language is very similar to the language of the prophets. And let me quote a couple of the prophets for you, Micah and Amos, who were contemporaries. They were 8th century BCE prophets, Micah in the southern kingdom of Judah and Amos in the northern kingdom of Israel. Here's what Micah said, and I think you'll see some of the similarities here in chapter 6 of Micah. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before the Lord with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? So it's rhetorical questions here. He ups the ante though. Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? to act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with our God. So here, I think we have the language of justice and mercy and righteousness. We have this sense of openness, this sense of, as the psalmist in Psalm 40 says, here I am, God, is all about being open to honest life, to living life honestly, openly, righteously, to not denying things that are going on around us, things that we're going through, things that other people are going through, and justice being key to that, not denying injustice, pretending it's not there or walking away from it, not hiding behind our religion, not hiding behind platitudes or good intentions, but taking it really seriously and acting, if you like, joining with God around whom we're centered in action, loving action in the world. Amos kind of takes it to another level. It's almost hard to hear, to be honest, but this is what Amos says in chapter 5. I hate, I despise your religious festivals. Your assemblies are a stench to me. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, I will have no regard for them. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps. But let justice roll on like a river and righteousness like a never-failing stream. Very similar kind of language. And again, I think this is so relevant for us at the moment, in this moment in history. We could just walk away from the injustice that we're seeing. We could wake up for a bit, become aware, and then just passively walk on. And I think the psalmist here is saying, we've got to say, here I am, God. We've got to be vulnerable. We've got to stay in that place, stay in that moment, and see this through, and do the soul searching, and do the repentance, and take responsibility and accountability, and bring about change. That's certainly the message of the prophets, and I think it's inherently the message of the psalmist here in Psalm 40. The psalmist goes on, do not withhold your mercy from me, Lord. May your love and faithfulness always protect me, for troubles without number surround me. My sins have overtaken me, and I cannot see. They are more than the hairs of my head, and my heart fails within me. Be pleased to save me, Lord. Come quickly, Lord, to help me. May all who want to take my life be put to shame and confusion. May all who desire my ruin be turned back in disgrace. May those who say to me, aha, aha, be appalled at their own shame. But may all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. May those who long for your saving help always say, the Lord is great. So I think here the psalmist is giving us three ways in which we get in the pit in the first place. And these, I'm sure, are not exhaustive, but my sense is the psalmist is talking about the troubles that surround us. That's the psalmist's phrase, which I would imagine are the things that we don't really have any control over. Stuff happens, life is, and sometimes bad things happen and we find ourselves in really difficult situations for no fault of our own and no fault of anybody else. And again, in those situations, we have to center ourselves. But there's also the sins that the psalmist talks about, the sins that blind us and the things that we do ourselves, the wrongdoing, the actions we take that are really not good. And perhaps we're very short-sighted about them and we don't really see the full implication of them. And we can relate to that, I think, because we all do things that get us into trouble. And probably we have cycles of that, right? Patterns of behavior where we end up getting stuck and it's really hard to get out of it. And then thirdly, there's all those who are trying to oppress us or our enemies, if you like. And this sort of touches on this theme in the Psalms in general, where there's talk about enemies and even cursing of enemies and a desire to see enemies judged and brought to shame, brought to justice. This section is relatively mild compared with some other Psalms, but I think what we're seeing here is the calling out of people in our lives that are causing us pain, that are causing us great difficulty. And at one level, that's perhaps people who we have personality conflicts with, people we don't get on with, people who are just bringing in some sort of irritation into our lives. And that's probably true. But I think there's a much more sinister meaning here, actually, because some people really oppress others and create unjust systems or perpetuate unjust systems that really oppress others. And our tendency, I think, when we read any of these psalms, is to think of ourselves as on the side of the psalmist. So when we say, save me, God, you know, crush my enemies, save me from my enemies, we're like, yeah, that's me too, save me, God. Whereas perhaps for some of us, we might need to consider, are we actually the enemy? We might be the one who's actually putting people in the slimy pit or keeping people in the slimy pit of injustice. And we are the enemy. And again, this seems to be very relevant for us today. If we think of racial injustice as a slimy pit, walls that you just run up against and cannot get over and just slide back down again and just sink back into the mud, that might be the experience of a lot of people in our country. And if we're going to be friends rather than enemies, allies rather than enemies, then we need to do something about that. The challenge is not to be an enemy, perhaps, in this psalm, as much as it is for our enemies to be vanquished. What does it mean to be an enemy? We probably don't think of ourselves as enemies, but I think in this present moment, we're becoming conscious, for white people like me, that we have been complicit. We have been silent. We have not taken responsibility. We have not owned the problem of racial injustice in our country, and we haven't taken action. And that has to stop. We've got to do something about it. Coming back to that statement earlier in the psalm, here I am. I'm not going to escape. I'm not going to run away. So I think these are really challenging words from the psalmist, if we look at them in that light. And I encourage you to dig deeper into this psalm yourself. I've obviously shared my thoughts here. There are discussion questions available. You can download those from our website. Discussion questions and prayer exercises that you can do as a group together or on your own or with a friend. Really encourage you to wrestle with the issues here. I think it's a very challenging psalm. I'm going to bring in Steve Mather now. Steve's a longtime member of our church community. And as part of this series, we're interviewing various members who are going to be sharing with us about their own experience of God through these psalms, but also just in life in general. So let's bring Steve in right now. Hey, Steve, thanks so much for joining us this morning. How's things?
It's going well. How's it going, Matthew?
Pretty good. So thank you for being willing to chat with us. Let's just jump straight into it. You know, we've been talking a little bit about racial justice in the context of that psalm, and obviously all kinds of things going on at the moment, this heightened sense of awareness about systemic racial injustice. How's that impacted you? How are you interacting with everything at the moment?
Wow, if I had to pick one word, it's very overwhelming to see what's going on all around me in this community, Cedar Ridge community, in the country and the world. But I have to express also some positive experiences I've had in the last several days or weeks. Just seeing so many things, not just on screens like this, you know, on the news or on social media, but there have been a number of opportunities where it's been really helpful, really, for me, meaningful to be a part of like the vigil that we had at Cedar Ridge like a week ago. I mean, you were there, many of the Cedar Ridge members and people from the community were there. It was just really helpful to be able to come together, be in a moment together, express this pain and frustration, you know, like lack of justice in this kind of world was just really difficult, but helpful to be doing that as a community there at Cedar Ridge. So, I mean, overall, I'm doing okay. I'm doing well, but I'm trying to deal with some of these things from my own perspective too.
Yeah. What's your sense of, you know, we've been talking a lot about white people needing to own the problem. How does that resonate with you? What's your response to that?
Well, so it's kind of interesting. I don't think that's a new concept to me. I feel, you know, I identify myself as a white person, a white male. I do see a lot of the privilege, a lot of the benefit that comes with that, you know, identity. So I feel like I've thought of that for a long time, but even if that's true, I still am finding more reality behind that. For example, Tinica and I watched The 13th not that long ago, a few days ago.
Yeah.
And I learned stuff from that film that has been just kind of like in the reality that I've lived in for so long, but now I'm seeing it more clearly. And I have to admit, I feel like I have at least two reactions here. One is I'm overwhelmed. Like I feel I can't really come to the truth that is out there, that just because I'm white, I've had so many opportunities and positive things in my life just because of my skin color. It's depressing to face that reality. But then there are moments like at the vigil or some of the other protests and marches that I've been in recently that also stir me instead of being just really depressed about how horrible this is. And this is just from my perspective as a white person. I'm thinking it's 100 times more true for somebody, a person of color right now.
Yeah.
But like I said, I feel stirred. I feel like I can't just watch this happen going on and on and on. I have to participate. I have to join in and I have to listen. I have to be a part of that.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting moment. It's a surreal moment, I feel like.
Yeah. It feels unique. I mean, we seem at a unique point, hopefully a turning point, but hey, thanks for sharing that. Let's talk a little bit about the song. I know you probably heard the song we played at the beginning of the service with the video of the vigil. I know you're a big, long-time U2 fan. So tell us a little bit how you've related to this song in particular, and maybe even to U2. I mean, they've been a bit of a soundtrack for your life in some sense.
Yeah. So yes, I love U2. That is true. And this particular song, which is based on the Psalm 40, has meant a lot to me over time. So if I go back in my journey back to, say, when I was a young child or in high school, particularly in high school, I was part of a community that really cherished the scriptures. And so Psalm 40, a lot of the New Testament were things that were really important to us as a community, a Christian community. But I have to say that particular song by U2 has meant a lot to me because I, at that stage in my life, I was a young Christian who thought, I can see what this song means to me. It means that the person who wrote that is crying out to God because that person, the psalmist, is in a place of despair, a terrible moment of their life, and they need help. They need to be rescued, right? So the idea that I had at the time is call out to God, ask for God to come into that moment and pull me out of it. I have to say, I don't see the psalm that way anymore. I feel like I've come a long ways, and I still love the music. I still love the scripture. But for a lot of reasons, I've interpreted it a different way now.
So, I mean, how would you interpret it now? How would you see it differently?
Yeah. So instead of, what I came up in is first a Catholic and then an evangelical Christian point of view is, we all are in a terrible place and we need to reach out and be rescued by God. And only God can do that. Now, years later, I feel like that psalm is not saying the same thing to me anymore. It's saying, open yourself up, be honest with what you feel, what you experience, share that out, cry that out. When that happens, you're opened up to the experience of God in a new way, in a different way. I have to tell this quick story. When I was in high school, I had a really good friend of mine go to a U2 concert, which I got to do, but not until much later. I was so jealous of my friend in high school who got to see U2 perform a great show and then close out the concert with the song 40. And here's what he did. He bragged. He said it was in a moment of worship. Like this whole crowd at this huge stadium was all singing along. How long to sing this song? How long to sing this song? And not only that, it was, thousands of people doing that together. You can imagine how special that would have felt. The concert was over. People were walking out of the stadium, going back onto the metro, still singing that verse over and over and over again. And I just thought that's the kind of experience of energy of God that I wish I could have had that moment. But to bring it back to now, I feel like the song is telling us to open ourselves up and we'll see God is there. God is already there. We thought God was far away. God is with us. And we see that not just one-on-one, an individual experience, but I feel like we see that through the people around us, through the situation around us more than we had before we opened ourselves up to that.
So I mean, that's a pretty significant change in the way you experience God, the way you relate to God, or the way you try to understand God. So, tell us a bit more, like what stimulated that change? I mean, that's probably been over a fairly long period of time. What's happened to provoke that change in you?
I mean, so much obviously in my life has happened, but I would point to a few moments of pretty difficult experiences. Like, I feel like I've had a few moments that really changed the way that I thought reality was. It changed the way I looked at God, how I experienced God. So most of them, I mean, honestly, they're all really rough moments, probably the lowest parts of my life across my whole 45 years. And I would go first back to the time when I was in high school. I had a really difficult experience between my junior and senior year. It was 1991. And it was probably the first time I really felt my faith in God, my understanding of reality was just really shook, really crushed. So what happened, I was with a bunch of my friends. It was summertime. We were at a property in New York State. It was a really beautiful campground. Again, strong Christian evangelical group. But what I had to deal with was a phone call that came to me from my parents. It was 1991, and I get this call that my brother, who was 9 years old at the time, his name's Patrick, he suddenly passed away. So my parents were just smashed, and then they reached out to me just to let me know, and I was hundreds of miles away. So it was really difficult just for that to come out of nowhere. What I can say is the friends that I was with, they helped get me home as soon as possible. Within a number of hours, I was back home close to my parents, my sister, and the weeks and months ahead were just horrible. But I would say that's a moment where I didn't probably think this at the time, but reflecting back, you know, months later, I just felt like, what just happened? Because I believe in God. I believe God is all powerful and would protect me. And if I'm faithful, if I believe the right things, then there won't be that kind of trauma and pain in my life. That's what I thought at the time. So it was really difficult to reconcile what I was going through with Patrick, my brother dying, and my faith and how I was hoping to interact and experience God at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that, Steve. I mean, that's really painful. You said that there were, is there anything else you want to share? I mean, you mentioned that there were several things. I mean, obviously you don't have to go into all the details, but you know, what else on your journey?
Yeah, I mean, it does take time to get past something like that, and kind of for me to process it and try to still reach out and be, you know, in connection with God. But I know in that first trauma in my life, I relied on the people around me, and that became even more true years later. So my wife Tinica and I. This was 2005, and it was soon before I met you, and you were part of Cedar Ridge. We had one child, my eldest son, Will, and we were expecting our second. So Tinica was pregnant. We were so excited. It was getting very close to when our next child, Jackson, would be born. But things just, again, they just went in a direction that there was no way I would have believed that could have happened. At that point in my life, I was thinking not just because God would save us and protect us from it, but just because it was going to be such a beautiful thing for Jackson to be born, for us to have a family like that. But all of a sudden, you know, Jackson was born, but he had passed away. He was not born and added to my experience of life the way I had hoped and been looking forward to. So as you can imagine, just like when my brother Patrick died, it would have just totally taken the breath and the life out of me, out of Tinica.
Yeah.
But what happened soon thereafter is I couldn't help but look around and see that people were right there with us, right? Close friends, family, even people I don't know that well, strangers were just so available and present with us. So it started to continue to shift my ideas. Like, it's not about how strong or how well I believe in God. It's more about opening myself up to the community, to the love that was around us throughout all of that. And one more moment that's more recent, just a few years ago, again, Tinica and I, our two children, Will and Violet, we faced some really hardships in our finances. Some of it was related to jobs and taxes and all these things. But I have to say, the only way that I could connect to, you know, the reality of God, to the reality of that moment, was because people were there with us. I mean, you were with us, and so many people at Cedar Ridge were standing there with us, not just to rescue us the way that I would have hoped as a young kid God could rescue us, but because we were supported, we were there with, you know, a community of love that helped us get through that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, as you talk about that evolution, I mean, what I hear you saying, and I certainly don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's almost like, whereas maybe before, your experience of God was defined by beliefs or accurate beliefs, now it's more defined by the community around you, and not necessarily believing exactly the same thing. I mean, for instance, I would imagine you might look back, like when you lost your brother and your beliefs began to change, you might have very different beliefs now to the people who gathered around you then, but yeah. You still see great value in that community, people gathering around you. I mean, is that accurate? That's how it's kind of moved for you.
It really has. And I would say two things on that note. Certainly the people, like back when Patrick passed away, my best friends who were also there in New York, they came back. And I think they were watching me go through it. They were there with me. I felt supported. But I think they were trying to still put this idea together that, oh, okay, we have to believe harder. We have to be more faithful in God, and then we will get through this. We will be better. But I appreciated that they were there with me, even though we weren't seeing it the same way. And as you're saying, over years, I feel like I don't want to say I've thrown out the idea that beliefs matter, that what we think of God is important. No. Right. I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying that the people who are beside me who have that belief as the kind of like focal point, they really need to know what to think and believe about God. I still love them, and they still love me, and that's so important. I just feel that I'm in a place that's different now, and helps me reconcile the things around me, the things that I believed as a younger person, and I think what I expect in the future.
Yeah, I mean, what I hear you saying is it's a kind of move away from a more individualistic view of God to a more corporate, collective, community view of God. I mean, I can share that in that experience as well, because, you know, I think when I was growing up, it was very much about believing the right things, and if other people shared those beliefs, then you had community, you know, if you were all on the same page. Whereas I think what you're talking about, and certainly how I feel my life's moved more, is there's a beauty and a greater depth and breadth in the experience of God by sharing it with people who see it differently, you know, who have different perspectives. And, you know, that there's a connection in that sort of transcends any one individual. So, I mean, for you, like, how does that work out now for you? Tell us a little bit about in the present day. And obviously you're part of this community, right? You're part of Cedar Ridge. So share a little bit about what that means to you now.
Yeah, I've been part of Cedar Ridge for a long time, as you know, a little bit longer than you, not to brag. But I think Cedar Ridge has been for a long time for me, a place where, you know, we won't all agree. And that's not even our focus, is to agree on what we think, what we believe. But it's about accepting one another. It's about being one as opposed to being right. I feel like our community, Cedar Ridge community, and that's one of the places where I feel like I've experienced this experience of God through connection of others. I feel that in certain circles of my friends in this neighborhood that I live in, certain members of my family, I feel that for sure. But I would just have to say Cedar Ridge has helped me continue to move in a direction that I already started on when I went through some of those really rough moments in my life, where it wasn't about if I could just get these things right, my life would be good. It was more about open yourself up. Know that love is at the center of it all. Love is the definition of God. And at Cedar Ridge, that's one of the places where I feel like we continue to examine what that means. And I have to see if I can, I just want to share this one analogy. And to me, it helps me visualize what it means to be, you know, unified or a collective. I live near Blair High School, and now that we're at home a lot more, working from home or doing other things, but without, you know, going out like we would in the past, I'll take a walk around Blair High School, and there's this big grassy field. And this happens almost every morning when I get a chance to do this walk over at Blair. There's many birds that in the morning hours, they'll come down on this big flat grassy area. And the way I just watch them move around and interact, it reminds me that there's maybe 100 individual birds, but they're all moving and surviving in a way that's connected or unified, right? So if I'll see them over here on the big field, and for some reason, one or two of them will start to get active and start to fly over to this other side of the field. They all swarm across that field. And I just think through, like, that can be a really good picture for me in terms of journeying forward in my life. I don't want to be that one bird that goes way over there by himself, even though I think my personality or, you know, some of my ways of seeing things, that's more who I could be. But as a community, like moving through like the reality of today, moving through questions that come up in my life or struggles, you know, sufferings, all those things. To me, that kind of communal perspective has really become central to how I see God. It becomes much more that than what's my answer to the question about, you know, the Ten Commandments or predestination and that sort of stuff that really was important to me in the past.
Yeah.
They're still important, but that's not at the center of what I feel like at Cedar Ridge we are, and that for me personally, that's not where my faith starts.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I mean, I think that move away from individualism to a more collective approach is why for us racial justice is such a key issue, right? Because if we see God, experience God in community, then when there's a rift in that community, or when there's separation, when there's injustice, or dehumanizing of people, that's a rift in a divine experience, if you like. You know, it's an inadequate experience of God, and so really, that's why racial justice is such a core part of our spirituality, or needs to be such a core part of our spirituality. You know, here as a community. Steve, really appreciate you sharing this morning and being so vulnerable. We're just going to wrap up a little bit here. And I know you're going to present communion in a moment with Tinica as well, so you probably need to get ready for that. So thanks so much, Steve.
Yeah, thanks, Matthew. And thanks for sharing your thoughts, too. It was really nice.
Thanks, Steve.
So you may have noticed that we didn't actually finish the psalm completely. We left out the last verse, and we're going to look at that now to help prepare us as we go into communion. Steve and his wife Tinica will present that for us in just a moment. But let's look at this last verse. Ends in a very similar fashion to how it begins. But as for me, I am poor and needy. May the Lord think of me. You are my help and my deliverer. You are my God. Do not delay. So we have here, I think, an admission that we have need, that we need help. And we need to draw close to God. We're asking for God to come. In other words, we're going to recenter on God. And that recentering, I think, is a great thing to do when we take communion. It kind of, we remember Jesus, we kind of recalibrate. I could imagine we might respond in one of a couple of ways. I mean, there's many ways to respond. But in the light of this psalm, the recalibration for us, the recentering, if you like, might be a recentering on the reality that God is for justice. And we become aware, and we need to continue to become aware and own and repent of our complicity in racial injustice in our society. But with the hope that recentering is possible, we can recenter, we can be different, we can wake up, we can become more tuned in, we can say, here I am, and live differently and act differently. So there's hope in this. Likewise, we might feel that our recentering on God, what happens as we recenter on God is that we get in touch with our weariness, our burden, our worn outness, because we have been subject to oppression, to racial injustice. And this recentering reminds us that God sees, that God recognizes that we have enemies, that we are not unseen, that all this is not hidden away. And that perhaps even at the moment, Some of this is being exposed in ways that it hasn't been before. And that's also full of hope because God is with us. God is with each of us in that struggle, in that tiredness, in that burden. So however we're responding to this morning, we can come into communion, a time when we remember Jesus, with both challenge, but also incredible hope.